Professor Lane's Constitutional Law in room 308 on the 10th of November.
Thank you. I'm Yeah. Yes.
Are you an Catholic?
I'm talking to myself.
Your podcast.
Should be okay.
Yeah. What are you? Why are you doing it? Oh, okay. No, that's fine. Sit in the room. I'm teasing you.
Okay.
But I'm not going to be able to teach this thing. I'm going to get back down and get my book, which I will do. Sorry.
You eat? Well, you can eat if you can't chew. You chew.
I got to trace my steps. I'm going to be a minute because I left my notebook somewhere and I got to go retrace my steps.
I don't know.
Go to page 252. I just want to show you some language in a couple cases before we go to move on to market participant and privileges and immunity. So this is the called modernizing the balancing test, whatever that means. But if you go to, if you look on, so this case is about cantaloupes. And we all like cantaloupes. Oh, this right? Cantaloupes are good, especially when they come from Arizona and they're packaged in California. They're really good. So that's these cantaloupes. They're not so good when they're not ripe. Good for you. Weight control, health. They're orange, so they give you carotene. What's today's date? So, Arizona had these rules for how, neutral rules, not discriminatory rules. They were neutral on their face. They required all Arizona cantaloupes, all cantaloupes grown in Arizona to be packed in a particular way. Provision the Act requires that all cantaloupes grown in Arizona and offered for sale must be packed in regular compact arrangements in closed standard containers, etc., etc. And so some Arizona company, and the reason for this is, it doesn't get contested in the case, the reason for this is they want to maintain quality, protect against fraud. So there's some
positive reason, state positive reason for this. Okay, so it's not, there's not a secretly discriminatory reason as far as we can tell for this, or that the case is really dealing with, that the court wants to deal with. It's simply a question of, and so, Bruce Church Company grows a lot of cantaloupes. From Arizona, grows a lot of cantaloupes in Arizona, but has its processing, does its packaging and stuff in California in a particularly different way. And there would be a cost of a couple $100,000 or so for Bruce Pike or Bruce Church Company to conform to the Arizona statute. So they say, no, we're not doing it. You can't do this under the Dormant Commerce Clause. That sleeping giant that we spent so much passionate time with over the last couple weeks. You can't do it. Because my harm far outweighs any benefit that you get. So even if your reason is legitimate, this is not discriminatory on its face. So here's what they say. But application of act through the appellant's order by the appellee, this is in the middle of 253. The cantaloupes grown by the company in Park are of exceptionally high quality. The company does not pack them in Arizona and cannot do so without making a capital of expenditure of $200,000. The appellant's order would forbid the company to pack its cantaloupes outside of Arizona, not for the purpose of keeping the reputation of its growings unsullied, but to enhance their reputation through the reflected goodwill of the company's superior produce. The appellant, in other words, is not complaining because the company is putting the good name of Arizona on an inferior or deceptive product, because it's not putting that name on a product that is superior and well-packaged. You can read on. Although it is not easy to see why other growers of Arizona are entitled to the benefit at the company's expense from the fact, but the state's tenuous interest. See, what they're doing is they're balancing. The state has an interest, but that interest becomes tenuous. The company has an interest, the economic interest, which is injured. Right? And there's the interstate interest, right? Because it is a restriction on the way that somebody is doing business in California and how they would have to do business if they were to come into Arizona. Now, I don't actually see this case as much different than the Apple case that we talked about a long time ago, although the Apple case seemed to be more discriminatory on its face. But if you just think about this case, they're saying these people want to send cantaloupes in. This is what's happening. They want to send their cantaloupes in. Probably says church cantaloupes. So in Arizona, that's a really good thing. We all buy things that say church cantaloupes. Your church. So you send in these cantaloupes, and they get to the door of the state, and there are sort of the cantaloupe immigration officers waiting there saying, not you. Why? Because you don't look like us. You got funny packaging. And so he's saying, hold on. They're stopping my product at the gate on the basis of funny packaging. They're not establishing that this is an inferior product. They're not establishing anything at all. So yes, they have some reason for the law, but the application of the law in context is discriminating in this case against an out-of-state product.
It's an in-state product packaged out-of-state, but it's discriminating against the flow of commerce. I'm not sure why it's modernizing, actually, when I read that. The title, Modernizing the Balancing Test, we've already gone through all these kinds of cases. The Raymond case, you absolutely understand. We've talked about this several times. Once again, transportation, you know. State, actually the transportation case is 1,000 times better to understand the problems with. It's hard when you're not from Arizona and you're not passionate about cantaloupes and the eating of them. Probably don't grow them. It's very hard if you live on a farm around here. You don't grow them. So it comes to the rainy season and you can't get them perfect. It's not a good sign. So that's great. But, you know, you do understand trucks on your roads. That we understand. You know, those double trucks and all that stuff. And so there, states are trying to regulate them. For everybody, right? They don't want these big kind of trucks, and some other truck from the state comes through, and they don't want to stop their truck and break it down into two smaller trucks, so you take two doubles, and let's say they're 30 feet each, 60 feet, and the state limit's 55. So you have to pull one of them through the state, and then get another trailer, or another truck to pull the second trailer through the state, so you have two, or you have to send two trailers instead of one. You can all see. You can all see how that interrupts commerce, right? You're doing it one way, and now you have to add cost to the doing it. So the question is, each of those is, you know, how much does it interrupt commerce versus how great's the state's interest? What are the costs? What are the benefits? Each of those cases, right? So that's the Raymond case. We talked about the mud flap case. The mud cut case fell apart because the state couldn't even meet its burden of establishing that the mud flaps, these particular convex mud flaps, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with. I don't know if that's convex. Convex, whatever. Depends on which angle you're looking at it. Right? So that these special mud flaps, they couldn't prove that they actually enhance safety at all. So, you know. But again, just think of the elements. States are trying to do something in their state. Congress has not told them they can't do it, so they think they can do it. It's impacting commerce, or we wouldn't even be talking about it. And now the question becomes, does the Commerce Clause itself say no? The sleeping Commerce Clause, not the awake one, which is something to talk. The awake Commerce Clause always speaks through congressional act. The sleepy Commerce Clause speaks through, I don't know, the court. God, I guess, somehow. That's how it does it. No, you can't bring your truck through my state. What will we do next? And so, you have to analyze it. Weight, how much value, premise, proposition. And the problem, we talked about this too much last time, but it's there for the opportunity. The problem is that when you do this case by case, you can't find perfect reasoning. Just have to get the sense of it. So I probably would ask you to be the lawyer and not the judge, because that would make it easier through an exam for you to have to think about it. You could become a lawyer and make the argument rather than the judge to make the decision, you know, absolutely this or absolutely that. Because we don't know the answer to absolutely, we just know the decision at the end of the day. So if you go to page 257 in the Raymond case. Thus we cannot accept the state. This is at the next to last, somewhere down there. I don't know. Below the quote, just above the last paragraph. Thus we cannot accept the state's contention that the inquiry under the Commerce Clause is ended without a weighing of the asserted safety persons against the degree of interference with interstate commerce. So, state alleges safety, plaintiff alleges interstate commerce problems. Nevertheless, it's also true the court has been most reluctant to invalidate under the Commerce Clause state legislation in the field only of safety when the propriety of local regulation has been long recognized, citing back to Pike v. Bruce, which was just dicta because the case got decided against the state, as you remember. In no field has this defense to state regulation been greater than the deference. In the highway safety regulation, thus who would challenge the state regulation said that must overcome a strong presumption. Despite the strength of this presumption, we are persuaded by the record in this case that the challenge regulations unconstitutionally burden interstate commerce. What are they? Just read that. You'll see the same argument. That's it. That's the argument. Right there. Everyone's the same. This one they happen to say, well, because it's things are falling out all over. Lose a glove. This one, if they give a stronger presumption to the state's interest in safe highway safety, they always say they do, but they don't. They say they do. If you look at the cases, you can't figure out where that strong presumption is. But nevertheless, here's the balancing test. Just look at it. Right there it is. Take any fact pattern and use that standard. Any fact pattern. As they said in Raymond versus Raymond and in Pike versus Bruce Cantaloupe, Bruce Church Cantaloupe. And remember, there's questions of proof here, right? You've got to be able to prove it. You have to apply facts. It's not the bold assertion you all had civil procedures. You can't assert it. You got to have some evidence that there's a safety. Probably in the highway safety, of course, you know. But you still have to establish long term, small term, what you're trying to accomplish. You know what I mean? You have to prove it. But that's the secret quote. There it is, the secret quote. Stick this in your mind and you'll be absolutely au courant. You'll be so hip with respect to Commerce Clause, non-discriminatory, non-facially discriminatory rules. Of course, the secret of them is how you apply it, right? So balance. But then, of course, cases start to look different. That was the discussion I was trying to lead you through last hour. The notion that there's lines get drawn because other concerns come into play. The lines aren't aware.
You say to yourself sometimes, if this case, why not that case? Why are they so different? How does this case differ?
And the answer sometimes is it doesn't really differ. But something's happened internal to the court that's created a preference for a different outcome for some reason. Too much federalism. Slippery slope. So where does it... It doesn't get shown. Sometimes it gets articulated, as we've seen, in different, in evolving doctrine. So when you look at the history of Commerce Clause, when you move from just things in commerce to things substantially affecting commerce, that's a doctrinal change. It expanded the definition of commerce. Right? That's, without knowing what any of those things are, you know that commerce, means of commerce, vehicles of commerce, substantially affecting commerce, are different standards. And then within those standards and their applicability, application, they're going to change sometimes, depending on the book. But then there are theories that never change, you know, balance. State interest versus the interstate commerce, the commerce interest. Theory doesn't change. The facts change, and if you get enough cases that are more restrained in the application, you start to say the application of the theory has changed because the courts become more something. Conservative, liberal, however it's going. Everybody has this, right? If I say everybody has this right and nobody says anything, if you were me standing up here and actually concerned that everybody had it when I said it, and nobody said anything, is it fair to assume that everybody had it? In my mind, it is. Because I have no other way of communicating with you other than asking you. Yes?
Can you explain a little bit about the concurring judges think that it's really narrow scope of decision in Raymond?
Isn't that a great name for a case? Raymond. We should name all our cases things like that. Spot. Raymond. Where is that? Just tell me the page.
Oh, it's 259. And, I mean, I try to take it to reasons, but I don't think I really understand.
Well, what are you having trouble understanding?
I mean, is it just that it's narrow because...
Does not signal for me a new approach to review of state highway regulations.
So why is it?
Should not be read to equate to the factual balance struck here with the balance established in Pike review. Neither the Pike opinion nor today suggests that a similar balance would be struck when a state legitimately asserts the existence of a safety justification for its regulation. In Pike itself, they weren't arguing for safety. So this is actually, notice who's in there. Rehnquist, particularly, notice Rehnquist. Think of every one of these cases where it's come out in favor of commerce over state. And Rehnquist, to a large extent, has been writing the sense. So this one he's all right about, but he doesn't like the application of Pike here, because he wants this to be about the safety. He's saying, look, what is really about safety? I do not want to be seen as favoring. I like that. I think I don't want to make the presumption in favor about safety equate to the presumption about equal to the presumption about other state interests. Now, whatever. Consumer fraud. So what he's saying there is, I'm willing to go along this time, but I'm not agreeing that safety is going to be the same as cantaloupes.
Okay.
There's still, when the state's regulating for safety, I want to give it a real special treatment. I want that presumption favoring its legitimacy to be really high. That's what he's saying. Okay? I'm tired of this topic. States as market participants. Oh my golly.
Yeah, it'll really screw you up.
Participants or regulators? Are the states participants or regulators? So, think back to the case Carbone. Everybody remember Carbone? Carbone was the case where Clarkstown, New York, our neighbor across the Hudson, and up a little bit. Decides that they're going to require all garbage picked up or in the town to be delivered to this one transfer station, which is to be owned by an individual, built by an individual, private individual, owned for 5 years, during which time rent will be paid, but during that period of time, the town will be able to have financed the purchase of the transfer station from the private individual to himself. And so the imposition of these costs by the town, and then the town makes a law that says everybody's got to go there, and there's a fixed fee, so that means even if you're going to another guy, processor, who's going out of state to do his processing, you know, picker-upper, transfer station. Everybody has it in their mind, you know what I'm talking about, transfer stations. It's where dump trucks dump garbage and hopefully sort it out. Right? They all come in, dump, hopefully it's sorted out, you dump it, you pay the price for having it done, and then whoever owns the transfer station is responsible for shipping, you know, this down to Virginia, this over to New Jersey, wherever, this to Staten Island, wherever we're shipping. This to some recyclable company, but there's this transfer station. So, I am a garbage truck owner.
Looks good business. Maybe I should have.
This guy in New Orleans has done really well. He keeps me really clean. And I have you as my not patient, my client. Customer, not even a client. And for years I've been coming by every day, give you a little bag of junk, and I sort out and take it. And I take it to some transfer station, I don't know, bartender, that's up here. I take it to Oneida County, some transfer station, somewhere else. Or I go to Pennsylvania, so it's good, you know, and across there to northern Pennsylvania, northwestern. A good part of the state now. And so, all of a sudden it turns out that I can't do that anymore. I gotta go right back to this Clarkstown place. And they're gonna charge me $81 tipping fee. So, this guy's put out of business, basically, you're gonna get my business. Obviously there's some reduced rates. You don't get them. I'm actually unnecessary in many ways because you could be dumping this thing yourself, or I could be picking it up. I mean, in the rural parts of the state, you have a choice. You know yourself. You just get one of the big things that's only $25 a week, pay $35 by a month or so, and you can get it done. Well, all of a sudden, the prices are now up for it. So, we complain. We say, hey, this tipping fee, even though it's applied to me, I'm a Clarkstowner. You know, you're driving up the cost of garbage. You're interfering with commerce. I can't, this law is stopping me, and it's hurting the prices that are, the other, you know, it's hurting other processors, etc. And the town says, I have a reason for this. I have a reason, we need to do this, right? And you went through that whole case, and the town was told their, whatever their reason was, which was, you know, they couldn't establish it well, and it was discriminatory in effect anyway, and it was, man, so this actually fell as being discriminatory on its face, as I recall, because even though it applied in, it didn't, I forget how that looked at. That you can read yourself, because we've already gone over it. So I'm not responsible for remembering it, you are. Unless you actually ask me, then I gotta go look at it again. Which I would. So then, now let's assume 5 years go by, nobody's brought any action, 5 years go by, Clarkstown owns the bloody thing. It's now the Clarkstown transfer station. Has the flag, the seal, you know, the picture of the supervisor. The town council people are all there. Maybe they don't want their picture associated with them. They're all there anyway. Now, same law, you gotta go there. You gotta go there. Or take a cement factory. New York City. New York City. You know, it's always hard to get cement in New York City. It's hard to build in New York City.
it's really hard to build because the logistics of building, where you store stuff, when your cement comes, how you get it in any skin, have cement trucks hanging around not doing anything, there's not a lot of property. You have to be really tight. And one of the big issues was getting cement to the city without spending hours crossing bridges and stuff like that. And also getting them off out of cement business. So New York created the Apple Cement Company. It used to be over there on the west side, somewhere by the water. Ship all the stuff in by barge, whatever they do, turn it all up. Trucks are pulling, you buy it. Right, you know. So it's much closer, it's under control, and let's say that New York had a rule at the time when New York was doing this. They would sell it to anybody that wanted to get it. Of course, nobody would ever come into New York to pick up a product except if it was fancy clothing. If you had to drive a truck in order to do it, right? This is not what we do in New York. We go away from New York. It's avoid traffic, not try this. We're traffic junkies of some sort. So move it to Arizona. Arizona builds a plant. Same problems. They run their own cement plant. It's not whatever state this is. What state is it? South Dakota? Yeah, South Dakota. I don't need to do it. Build a couple of cement plants. It's not hunting season. And they're selling it to North Dakota, they're selling it to Minnesota. Wherever else is near there, they're selling it. And they start to run short on their production, the quality, you know, whatever. They can't get the resources. And so they decide they're only going to sell it to Dakotians. South Dakotians, whatever they're called. People who were using it out of Dakota complain. They say, you can't do that. You're limiting commerce. Court says, what? Maybe they came from... Is South Dakota next to Montana?
It actually is.
Yeah, right. I think I just pictured that. With both Dakotas, right?
Yes. They made a distinction between when a state actually acts as a market participant, which was this case, as opposed to having a tax or something on that. And they think that when a state acts as a market participant, it's allowed to do that. Because it's not the same... And then South Dakota wasn't hindering out-of-state people from selling their cement there. They were just allowing access.
South Dakota wasn't...
They weren't stopping other people from competing against them in the state. And they weren't saying Minnesotans couldn't come in and sell their cement there. Or, North Dakota couldn't come in and sell their cement.
They just wouldn't sell it to them? Or they would allow you to compete against them,
right.
But you couldn't buy it?
Right. They weren't putting a restriction on
So, could South Dakota pass a law that said that cement made in South Dakota can only be sold to South Dakotians?
No.
Or is it South Dakotians?
It's
Dakotians. Cochins, right?
It's Dakotians.
Really?
No, because in that case...
You don't do it the French way?
No,
I just taught 3 hours of undergraduates. Go on. I don't know why. There's a non sequitur that has nothing to do with any of you.
No, because in that case, the state would not be acting as market participants, would be acting as they have the legislation that would actually, in that case, hinder.
So if the South Dakota passed the statute, does anybody doubt for one moment this can only be sold to South Dakotians, that falls. It's on its face. It's limiting on its face. Right? Everybody has that, right? You cannot pass that law that keeps certain everybody from every other state from coming into your state and purchasing products made in your state. Now, whether they would pass that, I doubt, because it would really irritate South Dakotian producers of cement, right? It would be pretty irritating.
Set up your business, and all of a sudden you have to sell it to South Dakotians, and since you're not selling them as much, you have to drop your price.
But they can create a business called what's the capital? Pierre? Or? What's the capital of North Dakota? Bismarck. So, you know, the Pierre Cement Company. They fund it. They create it. I don't know, they incorporate it, however, whatever the legal means they choose to do it. I don't think that's actually that relevant for this purpose. And they buy and sell, they buy the good and sell the cement. And then they decide, the company decides, we're out of, you know, their board is government officials or whatever, we're out of, we're running low on cement, we're only going to sell it to South Dakotians. What?
South Dakotans.
South Dakotans. Oh, I got it. You're not sure. South Dakotans. Thanks. You're always ready to help me. And I don't blame you. South Dakotans. Okay? So, what's the difference there? Now, you understand that according to some judges, the difference is none. But that is not the majority view. The majority view is that there is a difference. So we can first talk about the difference, but then we have to talk about an understanding of that difference. Do we get it? Does it make sense? Is it doing something that makes a difference, right? We have to understand it because one group says one group's perfectly willing to accept this and another group of judges are not. Just as a theory, before we look at it, all, you know, the various applications, this notion that there is something. Oh, Jesus Christ. There's more clothing falling out of that thing. This notion that there's some distinction to be drawn between because South Dakota in this case is in the business of selling its cement versus regulating the sale of cement in the state. That there's something different from a commerce clause the dormant commerce clause, that there's something different under the dormant commerce clause as a state or locality. Don't worry about that distinction. Just collapse it in your mind. Somewhere in your lifetime, when you ever come up with this, you should be alert that there may sometimes be a slight difference between the state and a municipality. There are, of course, there's no difference. That a state or a municipality regulating can't do it. Market participating, being a player in the market as opposed to a regulator of the market, that's the difference. So in this particular case, South Dakota is not regulating the market. It's not telling companies that they can't do business with. It's not telling its cement companies that they can't do business with out-of-staters. It's not telling out-of-staters that they can't come into North Dakota to buy or to set up their own companies or sell their own cement if they want to. There's no regulation of the industry. There's simply this company that's selling cement
only to North Dakotians. Which, of course, if you went in yourself to set up a cement plant, you could choose to sell only to South Dakotans, right? So if I went in and I set up the Eric Lane, Pierre, you know, cement factory, and I said, for South Dakotans only, you know, nobody else need apply. Of course, I can't say that. That's a different case. We're not at that case. That's the next case. Is nobody else need apply for a job. Nobody else come and buy. So I'm a private employer, owner. So, I don't know, I'm not stopping women. I'm not stopping the disabled. I'm not stopping people on race, color, national origin, religion, any other, whatever. Anything else I left out of the protected, statutorily protected, not constitutionally protected? I'm not the state, so you can't get me constitutionally. I'm not working for the state. I'm not, there's no state actor here. It's just me. Setting up my little business. So I can do that, right? I can choose to be dumb about it and just sell it to South Dakotans because I like them. I want only them to have my cement. Or I could be producing a lot of cement and selling it, and then all of a sudden I run out of cement. I don't have enough, and I decide I'm going to sell it just to South Dakotans because it makes damn good business sense. They're my neighbors. They're going to see me through these hard times. Why would I screw them up? So I do it that way. Anybody question that I can do that? No question, right? This is about the Commerce Clause, not about individuals trying to. Individuals can interrupt the Commerce Clause, private individuals. So the state as a market participant. And the argument that gets made is just the argument I made. It's like a private business. You notice the case they cite in here before we come circle back, Hughes versus whatever it's called, Alexandria Scrap? That case I don't get at all. That's the case which this case is decided based on. So this is a case where they give a bounty to processing companies that process hulks of corn, you know. People, you know, live in the cities and others do this big cars, but for many years the way you got rid of cars, most people don't drive brand new. This is before we all just rented our cars and returned after 3 years. You know, you bought your car and then you drove it like maybe you do now until, I don't know, I got like 60,000 miles on mine. One day it's just going to go pop. And I'm going to get out of that car at that moment, and what I'm really going to want to do is, you know, take out my iPod, my flashlight, throw them in my bag, walk away, file the numbers off it, and leave it. Less scrap is really high. Because what would you want to do with an old car? You know, you've been to rural places, like 100 of them lined up on the side of a road somewhere in some farm where every piece of junk is there. Of course they're there. What are they going to do with it? Spend $3 to $4 on moves? So, you know, America for years was lined with hulks of cars. It still is. You just can't see it in many places. So Maryland decides that one of the ways they're going to solve the problem is to pay a bounty. Now, what does a bounty mean? Subsidize, right? Subsidize. A bounty, like bounty hunter. Right? You catch that through your escape. We'll give you $20 for a scalp. $30 if he's alive. Whatever. It's a bounty. So we're going to get a bounty on these cars. And it works pretty well for a while. You know, a lot of Maryland cars are pulled in. So people that ride the roads look for them. They grab them, take them to a processing plant, whatever they do to them,
burn them in the scrap. Somebody gets a bounty if it's a Maryland-owned car. So then Maryland makes it harder for, I don't know, out-of-state processors to do the processing. So the advantage is the in-state processors and not the out-of-state processors. And people complain, I don't know, their neighbors, Virginia, because they're not getting the extra cost of doing it. Apparently, the procedural aspect, the application, the paperwork you have to do actually makes it almost impossible if you're an out-of-state person to do it. They bring an action, and somehow Maryland is considered a market participant and not a regulator, because they're not saying, they're not regulating, they're just giving subsidies. I don't know, maybe that's that case I asked you about 3 or 4 days ago when I said, what if the state of Massachusetts just decided to give subsidies to people in the state? I didn't think of it as a market participant, but, I think you can give those subsidies. So this is a case that I actually, this case... The Reeves case, yes. Are you going to confuse me again?
No, I think I'm...
Okay, now go. Don't be put off. Come on.
I just had a question about how you're formulating the policy in this case, because I think my understanding when I read the case was that they were simply honoring the residential contracts first, and then out-of-state purchasers could still purchase...
The cement?
Yeah, the cement case.
But they were out of... No, but the reason that they were out of cement... So they were only going to sell it to North Dakotans, South Dakotans. Where do you show read to me what you're thinking? I mean, there's fact there. I can't make you...
Faced with the same type of serious cement shortage that inspired the plant's construction, the commission reaffirmed its policy of supplying all South Dakota customers first and to honor all contract commitments with the remaining volume allocated on a first-come, first-served basis.
So it was a preference.
Correct. Because I think
it's a preference.
Well, I mean, when
assuming there was stuff left over.
I know, but I think that by stating it that way, I think that if they did say we'll only sell to some Dakotans,
that's one lesson we all learned. I
think that the outcome of the case would have been different.
So you think the case is outcome determinative on the basis of?
Well, I guess it helps, but I think if you're saying that you're only going to sell to South Dakotans without adding that additional...
If you're the state, the answer is you can't. The point is, can you if you're a private... If you're the state as a regulator, you can't. But if you're a business... So the commission is what? You said the commission.
Yeah.
Did you use that word? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I read it. The commission of the state of cement, so it's a state entity, right?
So, maybe. The distinction you want to make is the fact that they left open the possibility that they would sell if any was left.
Right.
It's not the same as the business saying that they're not dealing with anybody other than South Dakotans.
Yeah, I mean, I just think the majority opinion is contradictory if they're saying, it's a state and it's not protectionist because the state is, using revenue that's generated from its residents to benefit its residents. I think if you're looking at it just a private individual, that contradicts. But by allowing the supply...
So do you think the state could have done that by statute? And passed a statute that told its cement companies to first honor all existing contracts, then deal with South Dakotans only, and then later, if there's stuff left over, you can do what you want.
I think that it protects the legit state interest, but I need more evidence to develop this. I don't know. That's why.
See how I'm asking you that question?
Yes.
Because it seems to me that the distinction really is with the fact that the state's doing it as part of its, like a business plan for its company,
as opposed to a regulatory scheme by its legislature for the state. So we're going to, I want to come back to your point, though. Because, but, and if you look at this case within the case, there, in effect, what they've done by making the application process or the proof process so hard has been to stop anybody but Maryland processors from, you know, getting the benefit of the bounty. And the rule that comes out about market participation is that market participation, if you establish it, right, there, you cannot apply dormant commerce clause to it. So these distinctions wouldn't do if the notion is, once you're a market participant, no matter how you're a market participant, you're not subject to dormant commerce clause. It takes you out of it.
Okay, so then how do you determine? I don't understand how you determine.
Okay, we're going to come back to that. To how you determine the market, yes?
Thing I don't understand with this Alexander's crap.
Yeah, neither do I.
There was a statute passed on how could that not be considered.
Some mysterious case that many of us think was absolutely bizarrely decided.
Seems to me like, unless you're seeing it as a subsidy, but then if you're seeing, I don't see how a bounty is ever being a market participant. Now, I guess you could simply say, I mean, when we give subsidies to industries in New York State, we are not doing it as market participants, right? So when we give the Apple industry, or whatever, when we have a problem, we help people in the, after the floods in West, the farming in Western New York, we did a lot of subsidizing of some of the apple crops and some of the other kind of produce crops. We didn't, we weren't a participant. We were subsidizing for whatever our reason. So I actually have a lot of difficulty with that. That's why I raised it for you.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So Reed, the issue was, did South Dakota form a company, and it's only this one company that we're talking about, not a statewide scheme, one company, then we're just going to...
Could be five stores. It could be five plants. It should be 100 plants. They could have all the cement there is.
Right, but it's a company anyway, or five companies. So we're going to treat it just like a project, a private individual has formed that company.
Yes.
And give it the right to make that decision of who they help.
Right.
Do you have it? So that's the difference. So if you are in the market, if I look at what you're doing and what you're actually doing looks like you are a player in the market, producing, selling, whatever it is, then that is not the same thing as a rent, even though it may have the same effect as a state. You're just a state business as opposed to a state regulator. And that takes you out of the dormant commerce clause.
I mean, not every state's racing to do this, by the way. I don't want you to think that these frequent the state buying and creating companies. But it is, because what's happened here, the state originally sets up these factories, these cement plants, because they can't get cement. So they set them up. We're about to own AIG banks, but of course, that's a federal, so you don't have any commerce. The idea of the government as a market participant is not a foreign idea. It happens right now. It's happening incredibly frequently every day. We're seeing more examples of it. But the state acting of it, you'll see from time to time on certain industries where the state will start to run one of the industries. It's not because they're particularly, communistic or socialistic or whatever, istic, but because there's some problem with the industry in the state. And, groups lobbying to resolve the problem. Yes?
You said before that it could be five companies or 100 companies, but if it gets to the point...
Plants.
Almost all the plants that produce cement are controlled by the state. Doesn't the plant be like straw men at that point, where they basically are regulated?
There's 20 plants. They take up all the, in theory, you probably, like always, if I keep going down the road on the facts will break the rule, right? So I won't be able, I'll have to find an exception to the rule because, in your case, so many plants doing the same thing the same way ends up being a rule of the state, right? That's your point. I mean, I think that's a good argument. You have to sort of see that if you go along in that. And so, remember back to this conversation we had the other, Thursday. So, here's an example. We have this rule. Market participant not subject to dormant commerce clause. So, they can do what anybody else can do, the state or the locality, as a market participant, not as a regulator, you know, regulator making administrative rules, passing legislation, applying administrative rules, applying legislation, you know, so both in the stated policy or in the application of it. So the rule is that when they are acting as a market participant, dormant commerce clause, the commerce clause in its sleeping form cannot put its thumb on the activity of the state, of that state in that capacity, right? Can't come down and say, you can't do this because you are violating that fundamental principle of the commerce clause, which is interfering with the flow of commerce. Okay? So then you say to me, well, what if there's 4,000 of these, or 100, or whatever number, that all of a sudden the entire industry looks like it's been taken over by the state, right? Every factory that produces cement in South Dakota is a state-owned one. And, that wouldn't happen because, you know, how they couldn't make money out of that in the end. But let's just assume they did that. And so now does it remain, is sort of the planting of the flag in all those different places now change the topography from one of marketplace participant to regulator? Maybe. We don't have that case. Do you think it does?
Well, I guess if the state owns basically all the cement plants in the...
What's the problem with that?
And they say, well, we're not going to sell to anyone in South Dakota. What's the difference between doing that and passing a law saying cement factories can't sell to anyone in South Dakota?
No, because this was your point earlier. No, because other factories could come in and set up and sell to anybody they want. So there is no regulation that says you can't sell. So if I wanted to say, hey, I'm going to go up there and set up the Bismarck factory in northern South Dakota, I could do that. They're not stopping me, and I can sell anybody I want there. There's no regulation against it.
I guess that's assuming.
I mean, if you could create the economic situation where there was such dominance that nobody could ever come in there. I mean, the point I want to make, you push in any narrative for any case. You keep pushing a narrative through hypotheticals. That's the point of them, to make you kind of think about how to solve the problem. But every rule can be broken by a hypothetical. Right? If I keep pushing, if I keep expanding, and it's what if, and you're not allowed to say to me, oh, that's bull, nobody could ever do that. You weren't allowed to say that to me. You would just have to follow me down that path. Of course, we can make every rule illogical. And so when that happens, that rule won't be applied. Now, this is not something I agree with, but I will tell you that's what happens. That's what Thomas is doing in the case on page 5 of the supplement when he says, I no longer am willing to accept dormant clause jurisprudence. There's no way of drawing a line. He
simply saying that we're all over the board. We just can't find a reasonable, and that's the discussion at the end of the day. We can't find a reasonable or rational explanation of it.
I'm going to go to 7:30, so I'm not taking a break. Now we're going to end it.
Reasonable, right? That's what Thomas is saying there. So read. It's important that you read Thomas in that case, in the supplement. Just read it. You know, I never tell you it's important to read Thomas. Some of the stuff is fascinating. It's just he writes so dense. You know, I mean, there's things that he actually makes you really think about. I never agree with him, but he really makes you think about it. And it's important to pay attention to this. But this is an important, because if you want to try to understand the difficulty that people experience like this, why sometimes you start to sweat when you say, these cases are the same, they're fine, they're different. Read Thomas. Look, that's why they're dissenters here. They're dissenters, because they think this is stupid, this idea of a deer. Powell's, Brennan, White, Stevens. Four judges. We're talking for an hour and 10 minutes about a case that's 5-4, and we're worrying about the principle of the case. The application of the Commerce Clause to this case should turn on the nature of the governmental activity involved. If a public enterprise undertakes an integral operations in areas of traditional governmental functions, the Commerce Clause is not directly relevant, although that case has been overturned, National City Urban. If, however, the state enters the private market and operates, if it operates a commercial enterprise for the advantage of its private citizens, it may not evade the constitutional policy against economic balkanization. Right? This distinction derives from the power of governments to supply their own needs and from the purpose of Commerce Clause, which is designed to protect the natural functioning of the interstate market. The court holds that South Dakota, like the private business, should not be governed by the Commerce Clause when it enters the private market, but precisely because South Dakota is a state, it cannot be presumed to behave like an enterprise engaged in an entirely private business. The state frequently will respond to market conditions on the basis of political rather than economic concerns, like the state needs it, right? Because what are they saying here? You know, why would they be doing it? Well, because they get elected by South Dakotians, and so they're going to supply South Dakotans with more. So here, 5-4, right? They're not even accepting the argument, the way the argument is shaped in the majority, and this is the way the majority shapes the argument. So, you know, I don't want you to think it's not the majority argument. The rhetorical, you know, sort of the doctrinal lead on this has to be, you know, if you are a market participant, you're outside of dominant Commerce Clause jurisdiction. But there's a very strong dissent that says you cannot look at it by this kind of odd notion if you're a regulator or if you're a business. You have to look at what's being done. The function. Right? 5-4. The function. And if you analyze this from the functional point of view, you're really seeing that it's protectionism for South Dakota. That's the functional distinction. And why do you say that? Because what the argument is that even though it's a business, the South Dakota business as a participant doesn't simply have as its motivation commerce. It has other motivations. That's why they're doing it. Why else would they do it? They've done it for some reason that has to do with the reasoning of government, politics, protection of their citizens, health of their citizens, whatever that reason is, according to the minority, takes them out of being participants and makes them, in effect, regulated. Why? Because the effect of the state concern, the way the state concern is being expressed, is through keeping out-of-staters out.
doctrine. It exists. Put yourself, be a lawyer now. Don't be worried about it from a doctrinal point for a moment. Worry about it from a rhetorical perspective. You have a case before you. The case relates to arguably market participant. The client wants to know what the chances of success are. You're representing the person that wants to challenge the existence, challenge the sort of whatever the policy of the private company is, which is now injured in some way, right? An injury, you got a standing, you're hurt. I want to get my money, I'm hurt. Hire a lawyer, he hires you, you go and say, this is how I like to answer questions anyway, so force you to think about it. Not something. How you argue. So, you go and you analyze it and you say, well, okay, it looks like a market participant to me because it's not regulating, you know, look at this lingo. It's not regulating, it's participating in the market, it's buying and selling, you know. And then you say, so normally in these cases, there's no dormant, if we're talking about it, the question comes up in the context of dormant commerce clause. We say normally in this case is there's no dormant commerce clause jurisdiction, meaning that they're free to business. You know, find some other. Go talk to not a con law teacher, but go talk to a corporate law teacher or somebody that knows something about that. But from a con law perspective, they're okay. But then you might say, but you know, they're only okay 5-4. I don't know where the court is now. So we have to update this. And, you know, this is really holding you back. They're really being aggressive about this. Maybe it's the time to challenge this. You know, what are the chances? Well, one judge you need, assuming it was the same court. I mean, if you're really doing this, you'd figure out who is the weak judge, who might make a difference. And you say, well, one judge you need, so we, you know, there's a legitimate argument. You could bring this case, you know, it's legit. You've got to pay for it, of course. But it's a legitimate argument. We're going to argue what? We're going to argue that this is a totally disguised means for state protectionism. Because the fact that it's in this corporate form makes no difference. What makes a difference that the state is running this? Why does the state create this company? It has to create it for a state purpose. State purpose. Protecting its citizens, the health, welfare, economics. And there, that's, you know, that's the purpose. Let's look at the function. The function is protecting our state citizenry at the expense of out-of-state balkanization of commerce. That's the argument. Kind of legitimate argument there. Why? Because four judges told you this, and because you understand it. You can see how you see this either way. So you can get this. You know, you have a case, you have to really, really look it through. What other cases have come down the road? How is it held? Who's the court on this? Are there any other, if the judges have changed, is there any experience we have with other judges' views? How strong is the precedent? All of those types of questions go into the assessment of the case. But, you know, just on the face of this case alone, I'd never be reliable. I wouldn't bring this case again in the same court. I mean, I don't think they'd like that a lot. But, you know, get a little different fact pattern, show a really state. Maybe it's your point. They never are going to sell to. What was your point? Maybe they're never, but maybe we'll tighten up those facts to make them, maybe the case all of a sudden becomes the case in which nobody from out of South Dakota ever gets sold anything. So now I'm really making this point more strongly. Maybe that's the distinction that drives a judge over to the idea that maybe they're not going to take the whole bite and say, you know, it's not function, but that this isn't the mark. I mean, you attack it either way. You say, this isn't the market participant, this is a regulator, de facto regulator.
Or you say, this rule of market participant is no good. Now, you notice in the case they cite to National City versus Houston, which of course is gone, that's the Garcia case, next time maybe this case will be gone.
And you should take a look at footnote 1 on 269, because they ask the question that you want. Just help you a lot. Here. The role of the state as guardian and trustee for the people is said to justify the market participant exception. Well, doesn't that justify the... Why is that any different than the statutory exception would be, the regulatory exception? I think that note one actually, if it helps you a lot, bless you.
We have a doctrine called market participation. You all understand that. It's not loved. It's not warmly embraced. But it's out there. It comes from where? Where do you think it comes from? Why do we have a market doctrine? Why do we have it?
A doctrine that says when the state acts.
Well, one reason might be because it looks like a private entity. And some people who, you know, they, people on the other side who have not liked the dormant commerce clause at all, said, well, here's a way to carve something out of the dormant commerce clause. It's funny because, of course, state-owned businesses are what the definition of at least socialism and communism as well, so I don't know.
And the answer is we don't know why.
We have it because some case worked. It worked for the case. You can see the difference. Can you see the difference between, not in theory, but can you see the difference between the South Dakota factory making this cement because they couldn't get any product to do in the state, so they start to make it? I mean, now they're doing it for a state reason. That's why they're created, because the marketplace isn't providing them. So they're providing it. And
they're producing more than they need because not that many people are building in South Dakota for a while. So they're selling it out of the state. They're making some revenues. Then all of a sudden the needs go up and they say, our factory can only sell to South Dakotans. But that doesn't stop any other person that wants to sell. Anybody can come into the state. They can sell whatever they want. They can do it. I mean, that doesn't look quite the same as everything that we've been talking about. So if you're inclined not toward some iron rule about dormant commerce clause, if you're inclined toward, you know, the protection of state initiatives more than I might be inclined, you can get your hands around this as a distinction to make. State is a laboratory. State is a place where we experiment with new ideas. Let's not smother them all. Let's not have big government smothering every idea. You can see this. You can see how this happens. Okay, go to page 370, 271. I love this case only because it's about Alaska. And Alaska's in the news. That's Governor Hinckley. So there's job preferences
being given to Alaskan people. You get a lot of these job preference cases. A lot of localities like to do this. So let's assume a locality is paying a lot of money for construction. Okay, so the dormitory authority of the state of New York, or the school, construction authority of the city of New York, is building multiple schools, which they've done for many years, slowing down. And they take bids, and in their bidding specs, they require bidders to say that they're going to hire New York City employees only. New York City residents only. So, could New York State or New York City pass a law that says its employers, the people that live in the city, the businesses in the city, can only hire New York City employees? New York City residents? Could pass that law on the Commerce Clause? Could New York State pass a law that says companies in New York State can only hire New York State residents? Nobody says yes to that, right? That's a gone. Once it says only, and it has commerce, goodbye. Don't even have another thought. Only out. There's no onlys. You know, or is employment part of commerce? If you don't think employment part of commerce, then you could say, okay, let me reconsider it. Employment's part of commerce. But if employment's not part of commerce, if employment, part of commerce, and it says New York only, I would say to you, you're gone under the Commerce Clause. How can you say that? By the way, do you think differently than that? Can New York State government pass a law that says that it can hire, that everybody that works for it has to live in New York City? New York State? That's different than what I said as a regulation, right? You understood what I'm saying. You're talking about private. Anybody, all employees that work in the city of New York have to live in, or state of New York have to live in the state of New York. That's gone. You all understand. Can't possibly succeed under the Commerce Clause. What about the question of whether or not the state government can, which when it hires its multiple thousands of people that work in the state, can they make them all be residents of the state? How come?
Well, I just know that there are places to. So
Corporation Council of the City of New York, you have to live in the city. Many people have been trying to get the police department in the City of New York to require. For years it was, and then we stopped. Now people are trying to get. It was a big issue for years. Now it's changing a little as the demographics of the police department have changed. How do they do that?
I think because.
National cities. Certain things don't apply.
Yeah, and I think because because a state government worker.
State taxes.
Yeah.
You can do that. But what about this case?
Yeah.
1972, professedly for the purpose of reducing unemployment in the state of Alaska, the Alaska legislature passed an act entitled Local Hire under State Law. The key provision of the Alaska Hire, as the act came to be known, is the requirement that all oil and gas lease and easements or rights-of-way permits for oil pipelines, blah, 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 of which the state is a party, contain a provision requiring employment of qualified Alaskan residents in preference to non-residents. So, you know, you're listening to the House Sarah Palin has been negotiating this pipeline, this huge pipeline through the state. So they're allowing some for easement through the state property for the pipeline to some, whoever is the provider, right? It's been our great conversation over their international and commercial and financial experience all coming out of this pipeline. Despite the deal's imminency in the political world, it's at least 10 years away in the real world. So, now let's assume that as part of that easement, this is what this is about, as part of that easement, she requires that any company that gets that bids for the easement, part of the bid spec, has to give a preference to Alaskans who are unemployed.
I like that noise. It just was sweet. What we should be in the classroom since it's 7:30.
Anybody want to take? We'll just pick up on this tomorrow at 4. It's under the privilege of the immunity clause. I want you to think about it, both why it's not a commerce clause issue, why it's a, and then we're moving on to executive power, separation of power, and all of that other stuff. Okay. Thanks for the time. Am I doing a review class? I'm going to be away for some time. I got to see when. I would be happy to do a review class if we can work it out. I always say that, and then we never. Yeah. When's the exam? I got to do a review class before the 8th. I'm leaving. I don't know if that's going to work. I like it when the class is smaller. It feels so much more intimate. You should be doing your reviewing now because I can't do it. I gave you so much clarity in the last two classes. You should be so on top of time, right? I've made it so clear. It's the worst dream I ever had. Slitherizer. Watermelon and water.
Why do you feel
right?
You But It's bad because it's a lot, but it's also good because you know how to eat back. Thank you. I was sleeping.